Hi, this is Tessa from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This talk was recorded live at DFTB 18. Enjoy the show.
Hi, it's a wonderful opportunity to be with you today and share a little bit with you about anticoagulant therapy in children. When I tell people who are non-clinicians that I work with children requiring anticoagulant therapy, they look at me somewhat confused and think, why would kids need anticoagulants? Because the community perception of most people needing blood thinners is like this old guy. The average age of someone taking warfarin is 70. They normally take it because they've got AF and they need to prevent a blood clot or a stroke, or they've perhaps had a provoked or unprovoked DVT. In actual fact, the kids that I deal with in my clinical practice most weeks are younger, much, much younger, and they usually have a really complex underlying health state. It's very rare that we actually just see a kid who's otherwise healthy have a blood clot. And in the last 5 years, I think the complexity of this patient population, both in terms of medical and psychosocial complexity, is only growing. And so I hope during today's presentation to share a little bit with you about how the elements of environment, medication, and the family unit that's impacted by these medications all play together to impact on the quality of care we can achieve for this particularly vulnerable patient population. This is an scanning electron microscope image of whole blood clot in infants, children, and adults. And what you can see in those three frames is that clot looks very different in infants compared to children and adults. And this visual representation depicts a process known as developmental hemostasis, which is where we know coagulation proteins change in both abundance and structure from infancy through childhood and into adult. What this means is when we give blood thinners or anticoagulants to children, we are giving it into a fundamentally different ecosystem than that in which these drugs were first validated for use and determined to be clinically effective and safe. In addition, we know that we're giving these drugs to children for very different reasons. This data represents a review of our then 164 patients on warfarin in the community in about 2016. And what you can see is a vast majority of kids requiring warfarin have an underlying reason of having had the Fontan procedure. Many of you will be aware, the Fontan procedure is the third and final stage of palliative surgery for children born with conditions like hyperplastic heart syndrome. So it's a very complex patient population, usually with multiple comorbidities. And this is the cohort of children who we anticoagulate most. Now, I know that there's geographical, dispute around whether you need to use warfarin in children post-Fontan, and I'll come back to that a little bit later. What I would like to highlight is a very small red segment in this disc that represents the 6 children out of 164 who required warfarin for primary DVT. So the vast majority of these kids do have significant underlying health problems that make managing any kind of medication a little bit more challenging. In addition to having a very different environment, the drugs we are giving are known to be one of the class of drugs most likely to cause adverse events in hospitals. This is data that's not limited to pediatrics, but includes adults and children. And what we know is heparin and other anticoagulants are associated with the highest rate of medication-related adverse events, certainly in our campus. Now, this is medications that, as I've said, we use in children ranging from X24 weekers less than a kilo right through to strapping teenage boys in a hospital bed weighing nearly 100 kilos. That variation in dosing can have significant implications for children. Now, if you were to search heparin-related adverse events in PubMed or Medline, you don't usually get a very good return or yield on your investment of time. But if you do that same search in the grey literature, what you find is a vast array of newspaper reports about heparin overdose, usually in neonates, and often that's very fatal. And the reason for this is usually clinicians picking the wrong stock solution of heparin to make up an infusion. So we know these drugs can be unsafe, But we also know through work that I conducted in my PhD study that their children's response to this changes with age. When we expose children to high doses of heparin, usually the kind of doses that you'd start therapeutic anticoagulation with or during cardiac angiography, the ratio of heparin's activity against coagulation factor 10 versus 2 is almost 2 to 1. In adults, that ratio is always 1 to 1. Now, why does that matter? It matters because the most common blood-thinning medication test we do in hospitals is the APTT, or the activated partial thromboplastin time, which only tells us about heparin's activity against factor 2. So if we do an APTT in this cohort, we're actually only seeing a small proportion of heparin's activity. And yet these are the tests that we're making clinical decisions on in patients in our care, particularly in tertiary hospitals. We also have problems that none of these drugs come in formulations designed for pediatric patients. In increasing frequency, we're using low molecular weight heparins, or in our hospital, Clexane, to try and overcome some of the dose response challenges we have with unfractionated heparin. The smallest commercially available concentration of low molecular weight heparin is 20 milligrams in 0.2 of a mil, and this is in a non-graduated syringe. Usually the dose of Clexane we give is about a milligram per kilo twice a day. So our pharmacy sends a clinician into their laminar flow unit to be able to make up smaller concentrations for us to be able to give to babies of 10 milligrams in 0.5, but their shelf life's only a week. So we've got issues in supply in sending these out to families who might need this treatment for up to 3 months. For patients bigger than 10 kilos, we teach the families to expel the liquid they don't need from a 60 milligrams in 0.6 syringe. That confers a lot of responsibilities onto parents for preparing the dose of a drug they're going to give to their child. And for some parents, that can be quite anxiety-inducing. And then we've got warfarin, which I describe as being the most moody medication that's ever been made. I tell all families to expect that everything will affect warfarin until proven otherwise, but that will particularly relate to changes in medications, diet, and how well kids are. Given the average 2-year-old has 8 viral illnesses every year, it can be very challenging to maintain the stability of warfarin therapy in young patients. And for that reason, we're increasingly again using Clexane. Clexane has a far more predictable dose response profile, but it has to be administered by subcutaneous injection. It doesn't require as regular blood monitoring, and it's not impacted by as many other things in the environment that can change, but it has to be administered by subcutaneous injection. And what we find when we tell families that they need to take their child, particularly an infant, home and give them an injection twice a day of an agent that does sting when you administer it, it can be quite overwhelming for these families. We conducted a qualitative study a couple of years ago to find out from these families, what does it feel like when we send you home having to give your child Clexane, and how can we better support you? What we found in analysis of that data was this overwhelming sense of trauma. These families were deeply impacted by the need to have to inject their baby twice a day, and not only themselves, but the impact that this had on their family unit. This enabled us to create an education resource that we now give to our families who are taking a child home on Clexane. And we hope that that helps ameliorate some of the anxiety that they have in doing this particular procedure. But there's no doubt this represents a fundamental shift away from parents just as caregivers to parents as our partners in clinical care. And I think that we need to be incredibly cognizant of the impact that this can have on the parent individually and on the family unit. I said that I'd come back to this issue of warfarin versus aspirin after the Fontan procedure. Do we have people here from New South Wales? Yeah. So in New South Wales, after your child has had a Fontan procedure, you're normally transitioned from warfarin to aspirin at about 6 months post-surgery. The conundrum is, what gives better protection against thrombosis after you've had this major surgery where we know flow is going to be significantly interrupted, and where there's areas of low flow, you can have an increased risk of clot. At the Royal Children's Hospital, it's always been our standard practice, led by the cardiac surgeons, to keep these children on warfarin therapy for pretty much life. And we've been doing that for the last 20 years. But for our patients who are well connected, usually through parent support groups, they know that if they had their treatment or surgery in another state, they might be able to transition onto aspirin, which doesn't require any blood monitoring tests, which doesn't require as much lifestyle modification, and which isn't as impacted by changes in the world around the child. It's very interesting. In the last 5 years, there's been a number of key studies that have come out to suggest the clinical outcomes in terms of stroke and intracardiac thrombosis are relatively equivocal whether you're treated on warfarin or aspirin. And indeed, if you're managed on warfarin poorly, in that your INR hits the therapeutic range only 30% of the time, you're going to have worse outcomes. This information has started to be fed back to our patients in particular family cohort studies and sessions held to keep these families coming together to be able to discuss the long-term outcomes for their child. And when it was reported back, there was a sense from the cardiac surgeons in our centre that we would see this mass exodus from warfarin towards aspirin, because people would actually want to be able to have a medication that was more predictable and didn't require testing. So far, that hasn't happened. And there's a number of reasons we think contributes to the fact that our families are weighing up, certainly at the Royal Children's in Melbourne, warfarin as being not that bad. First of all, our families have access to a home INR monitoring program where we teach families to do INR tests at home using a finger prick test. They phone it through to our service. We do dosing over the phone. We conducted a study looking at the before and after effect of this intervention on quality of life, and we know that it significantly improved quality of life in children to be able to do this kind of monitoring in the home. We also know that for many of these families, having a number that tells them that their child is okay is incredibly important. So the prospect of going from warfarin to aspirin when they will no longer have a number telling them that their child is okay is actually quite disempowering. Whereas we've empowered them largely to be able to take control of treatment, be responsible for monitoring, and be co-leaders, if you like, in the management of their child's anticoagulant therapy. So in weighing up the risks and benefit of warfarin versus aspirin after Fontan, it's become apparent to us that it's not as simple as looking merely at what is the clot burden associated with each of these treatment options, but rather how are these treatment options internalised by the families whose child requires them, and what vicarious benefit are they actually getting out of being able to be on warfarin. And it's been quite humbling to see that, because for many of our families, we'll have the open conversation now about we do not know which is better for your child, and the vast majority of them don't want to shift. So I've tried to walk you through today some of the background information about why giving warfarin, unfractionated heparin and clexane to children is challenging, that relates to the environment in which these drugs are being given, the medications themselves, and the family involvement in care, and how we need to work with families to be able to help get the best possible outcomes. What I think I also hope I've been able to share is the fact that there is no one clinical guideline that you can go to that will tell you how best to care for these children in most of the occasions. Every interaction with a patient requiring anticoagulant therapy does have to happen on an individualised level to factor in both the empiric evidence that we have about why we're using this drug in this child, what is my experience of using this drug, and what is the family's experience and expectations of care. I've also alluded to the fact that these are complex kids. They will turn up to your ED, they will turn up in the general paediatric practice, and they will turn up on hospital wards and often for extended lengths of stay. As clinicians, we need to be very conscious of the fact that these families know their kids really well, they know these drugs really well, and we really need to develop a therapeutic relationship that will enable us to get them partnered in care, because if we don't get adherence to these drugs, we know we're fundamentally screwed in terms of getting really good clinical outcomes and giving the best possible future for these children. So this really relates back to the old principle of evidence-based practice. there isn't enough empiric evidence to tell us exactly what to do every time. Clinical experience alone is not going to be enough to guide our practice, and nor can we always acquiesce to what the family's wishes are. We need to think about these concepts and individualise them for each patient encounter that we have in order to be able to deliver the best patient outcomes for this cohort of patients. Thank you for your time.
Thanks so much, Fiona.
No worries.
At the risk of degenerating what was a really complex and interesting talk, I think the thing that's really taken traction is warfarin being the moodiest medication made.
Yep.
So Henry, Twitter did light up a little bit.
Absolutely, Jesse. Yes, Fiona, thank you. There's a lot of buzz on Twitter. People are also posting some of their photos from last night. And there's some pictures of people loading up on coffee, and I completely get that. I think our audience really was able to get a good feeling for the psychological effects and the trauma that our families feel when we ask them to stab their child twice a day.
Mm.
And one of the comments was asking about whether INR, that we need to wean families off them the same way we do with SATs monitoring and blood pressures.
Look, there's been no studies looking at can we manage warfarin without monitoring. There are studies that suggest in starting to look at low molecular weight heparin and can we just give dose-adjusted doses of low molecular weight heparin without monitoring. I think warfarin would be very tricky to engage with without laboratory testing. You know, the average patient we have will have an INR every 2 weeks, and we usually have, and even our most stable patients long-term who are having INRs every month, every now and then they'll go through a growth spurt or they'll develop new hormones that they didn't have last month. And that all seems to impact on how they respond to the drug. So a braver clinician than me might say, yep, let's scrap the INR. I won't be saying that, but I do think we need to perhaps not test quite as often because it is a long-acting drug. And if we look too quickly, we react to a dose that actually is no longer what's in the system now for that child. And so we actually need to sometimes sit on our hands, which can be a hard thing to do. But again, partnership with the families is really important because most of these families know that if you do that too quickly, if you change my INR too often or my warfarin dose too often, it's not actually good. And so listening to the families is really important.
Thank you. I also have a question from Ben Simon, who asks whether there's going to be a role for rivaroxaban in paediatric care in the future.
Rivaroxaban?
Yeah.
Yep. So there's a number of novel anticoagulants that target more precise elements of the coagulation system. Currently being trialled in clinical trials at the moment. It's important to note that none of those studies are yet some of them are mirroring the same cohorts that have been studied in adults like DVT, but as you can see, that represents a very small portion of our market. We've currently got clinical trials looking at rivaroxaban and apixaban in both treatment of thrombosis and primary prevention in cardiac patients. The interesting thing just to be aware of, I think, is that no one has yet found a novel anticoagulant that's good at protecting against clot in the presence of prosthetic heart valves. So there's no novel anticoagulants being used in adults for primary prophylaxis of a prosthetic heart valve. We are starting to look at it in kids post-Fontan. Now, we actually know they've got a lot of artificial circuitry in their bodies, and there's been no similar studies of a similar cohort in adults to tell us how safe that is. And so the outcomes of those trials will be really interesting. We don't need to monitor rivaroxaban. It's got less interactions with the environment, so that's good. Our families are not consenting at the rate we thought, again, because they like to have a number and they don't actually want to move away, many of them, from having something they've got a number. But I think it's important to know that our patients are different. And so whilst they look like a panacea in adults, they may not be the panacea we hope for.
Thank you. We also have a question from Jess Reardon, which is, how does anticoagulation affect the physical and social development of children? Are they wrapped in cotton wool for fear of a bleed?
Oh, look, I think on the one hand, we're quite fortunate that most of our kids have a chronic underlying health problem, and that problem usually limits their physical activity a hell of a lot more than what warfarin does. It's very different in our cohort of kids who get a blood clot out of the blue. Whilst they're a small cohort, we pretty much always have to refer those young people who are usually strapping athletic boys to our mental health service because they get clinically depressed because of the impact of lifestyle modification.
That's it from me. Thank you so much.
Yeah, so we'll hold up. We've got time for one more question, and there's an actual human asking a question.
Just one question. Can you talk to us about heparin boluses? Since PTT is kind of problematic, you point out, what's your recommendation for heparin boluses?
It's not a simple recommendation. I think we actually have to look at the APTT, the anti-factor 10A assay, if you've got a lab that can do that as well, and then at the patient. You know, the population of kids we're most monitoring high-dose heparin in are usually the kids on circuits like ECMO. So we can also look at things like, is there sludge in the circuit? Do we need it? How often are we changing the circuitry? It has to be multifactorial because there is no one assay that tells us the full picture.
Excellent. On that note, thank you very much, Fiona.